Ladies and gentlemen, we of course want to know whether Daniel tomorrow morning is actually going to cycle past the statue or decides to just stay in bed, because it's very hard to come up with a positive answer. And in order to avoid you staying in bed tomorrow morning, I hope that you are, because this is not a bilateral discussion between Daniel and me, or maybe Sherp, because Daniel is hinting at the European Parliament, and I know that's in your heart. But we would like to share the discussion with you. So I would like actually to ask, and look, there's already arms. Shall I limit my role then to walk and give people the microphone? Is that an idea? Okay. The first, can you stand up, tell us your name, and formulate your question or make your remark?
Yes, my name is Edward, and my question is about what you said. You said the national parliaments or the national governments can't make it, so the European citizen is better served if a new political order will be created at the European level. So then you would get a more legitimate political order than we have right now. But shouldn't this transfer from the national level to the European level be legitimate as well? Therefore, democratically elected, or and the problem we have right now is that it seems like most European citizens, at least in the north, wouldn't be in favor of this transfer to the European level. So then this transfer wouldn't be legitimate itself, even though you might get a legitimate political order. I don't know. You understand my question, right? Isn't there a problem there?
I'm not advocating, you know, that this is kind of solution that will be shoved down the throats of European citizens. Not at all. What I'm saying is that we need to start thinking in terms, and I think that European citizens need to start thinking in terms of, you know, which kind of political order actually puts them in charge. There is no way that you or I or anybody else can guarantee that we'll make the right choice. But if I had my pick, then I'd say, yes, let's go for national referenda, all fine. But then I want there only to be two options there. Serious form of European integration and no thing. Because what we have right now is something that's unsustainable. It's not going to be that. And that, I think, is something that has so far completely hampered debate, that people somehow think that, you know, what they think, you know, has been the kind of situation they've lived in over the past 5, 10, 15 years, that is an option that's on the table for the next 20. And that's not the case. When the Greek referendum was announced, I was all for it. I thought, yes, let's talk about it. Take your pick. What do you want? You want this, you know, with all its imperfections, you know, this austerity package and stay within the euro? Or do you say, no, we don't want it and we want to go? But just leaving things as they are is not an option. There is a chance, a very big chance, actually, that citizens of the northern European country will not think that way. I think, you know, it's not for their own benefit. So, you know, to my mind, you know, that is an important mission that we have here, you know, to start a debate about, okay, what are actually the options that are on the table, because the status quo is not one of them.
But I think with the Lisbon Treaty, with regards to referenda, we've all seen what happens then with the constitutional treaty, I mean. And when it comes to, well, you should give them the choice, but you still say it, that you hope that the coming 2 days, these world leaders, even though Merkel and Rutte, they are in favor of European integration and will support it there, even though you know that their population is actually against. So I see that there is a divergence there.
There clearly is a divergence there. I think the task for European leaders, again, is not to shove something down the throat of their own people. But, you know, if you think in terms of this ballot that you would ideally present to citizens at the end of the day, then, you know, the first step to be taken is to hammer out what is actually going to be on that ballot. What are the options that we have? What would, you know, the more Europe order look like? And then in the second step, you can say, okay, take your pick. What is it going to be? And to my mind, you know, this is the first step that is going to be taken. If it will involve serious treaty changes, then I think, you know, we already have a number of countries within the European Union where some kind of potential action, referendum, will be necessary to get those adopted. So it's really going to be in the minds of European leaders. But I think, you know, there is a fairly complex relationship between leadership, also leadership of your own people, and then, you know, at crucial junctures, getting back the legitimation. It's an uneasy consolation. You know, as far as that's concerned, I totally agree with you.
Okay. Does this relate to the previous question? Because what I would like to do is, instead of zigzagging between all kinds of different topics, I would like to first ask if there's someone who likes to follow up on this point. And then if, you know, if this is discussed, then we can move on to the next point. Is there someone who likes to follow up to this point?
I'd like to be to speak out as the advocate of the devil, because, of course, I represent the European Parliament, and thank you so much for your very interesting talk, and I really appreciate it. And but I mean, we are having these discussions, of course, on a day-to-day business. But where it comes to democratic legitimation on the European integration process, the question on the European Parliament is vital, of course. And here, although I fully agree with your premises that European Parliament is the pitch where democratic checks and balances for European citizens are at stake, and where they could go for their rights once, and to check the power, to control power in the European power arena or political arena, the key issue is at stake. Is European democracy possible? Is the European theater fit for European democracy? I ask this question because at the ratification process of the Treaty of Lisbon, which has been mentioned just the other minute, the national governments, and notably the Bundesverfassungsgericht in your own country, stated a very interesting position. They said, look, for real European democracy, you need a European demos, a European people. And there is no such thing. There is not a European people. So if there is not a common understanding on the issue and the notion that we form a European people, right, with its thinking, with its with the issues of identification, identity, issues north-south, structural imbalances between north and south, east and west, then if there's no European demos, then there is no European democracy. Ergo, you cannot have checks and balances on a European level. Ergo, the real democratic legitimation is in your own country, in bicameralism, in the Bundestag. Ergo, every step towards handing over sovereignty to a supranational level needs, as of that moment, needs to be checked in the Bundestag. Now, that's a very serious statement. So this statement is still up in the air, and I fully agree with you that the European Parliament should be the place for real democracy, but there are serious doubts on this statement in very important countries, in the European Union, notably in your own country.
To cut a long story short, I think the Germans need to make up their mind. I mean, you know, as I appreciate the respect that they, or I myself, being a German, you know, have their for their own constitutional law, but if there is the political will in Germany to amend the political order within which they find themselves, I think that is possible. 200 years ago, it wasn't obvious to people here in South Holland, you know, that they were part of the same demos as people maybe in Maastricht or in Leeuwarden. Or ask people in Massachusetts whether they think they're part of the same demos people in California or Oregon. No, they are, but it's not as though that is some kind of a natural given. There is an evolution involved in that process as well. Germany, the Bavarians, the Prussians, who have, you know, that was a historical process that brought people together. And there are numerous obstacles. You mentioned some of them, you mentioned some others. I'm not saying that it's easy, but I'm saying anything short of that is not going to yield a sustainable political order. And so we have to rise to the occasion, must do what's possible and what's necessary if we want to overcome this crisis. If we stop short of doing that, fine. But then don't think that 10, 15, 20 years from now, you'll still have something that vaguely looks like what we have now. Is that going to be gone?
Richard Griffith, one of your colleagues, Norman Davies, predicts the collapse of the European Union. And he adds something. He says, because Sharp is actually saying we are trapped. We are involved in a process of different scales, and you also mentioned it in your article on which you base your speech. We are trapped, and actually it's not that bad that there might be a collapse, because after the collapse of a polity, there will be a new one raising, and maybe then the demos urgency is revitalized. Is that something that I don't want to dramatize, of course. I actually study dramatization on political agendas. I don't want to influence you. But is this something that, is it connecting to your point, or am I making too much a jump now? So we keep you, I know your face, so I'll get to you. Is your point connecting to... Okay, yeah, it's intellectual exercise, huh? It's okay. Not for nothing.
Okay, thank you. First, I'll comment on the opening remarks. You mentioned about Angela Merkel and Sarkozy. There shouldn't be any fear about who is taking role as a leader within the European Union. If you want to promote, if you want to have a successful European Union, then you need leaders over there. And fortunately, Angela Merkel could emerge as a very good, strong, sustainable leader. She deserves compliments that she saved somehow, some way, the European Union and the unity. Now, second, I'm coming on yours. Definitely, you also deserve, I mean, compliments. You mentioned about economic, financial, and political sustainability. It's amazing to listen. You presented fantastically. I was thinking about that if any country within the European Union is thinking about that, to hell with other countries, they are the weaker economies, we can survive as a country like Netherlands or someone else, and to get rid of the European Union, a strong European Union, then they are living in fool's paradise. So my question comes to you now. Netherlands, the mortgage debts, which you mentioned, are 3 times than the general mortgage percentage of the European Union. So it's extremely alarming. You mentioned about distribution of the wealth and supply demand, economic rule, definitely. So what would you suggest the Netherlands and the financial market of the Netherlands and the economists to take measures to save them from this disaster, which seems to be possible because of the mortgage debts? Thank you.
You started in the air, but you moved a little bit away from the topic. and I want to, you know, I don't want you to put you. Do you like to address the first part of the question or the second half of the question?
I'm a political economist, so like the mortgage debt kinds of things, you know, that's really my home turf. So, can I?
And and I also feel like we are all part of the problem, right? When it comes to mortgages, I don't know. Do you have a mortgage?
Political sustainability. Sorry. What will be the source of the fundamentals, the basic, to while confronting you, that you said there are no people in the European Union, which I say there are people in the European Union, because all these parliamentarians, they are elected by the people from the European Union. So they are representing them. So do you think that if this thing continues and South and North debate gets stronger position, that this European Union will remain as it is today?
Okay. First, the mortgage bit, because I think that is important. Now that, you know, the Dutch government's real estate policy is nuts and has been so for quite a while, I think, you know, is these days an open secret. You know, economists, you know, from way on the left to way to the right, you know, they don't agree about anything, other than that the tax deductibility of mortgage interest, you know, should be abolished sooner rather than later. You know, that's that I think, you know, almost anybody agrees on. When I thought this through, right, you know, it's always easy to point your finger at all sorts of things and say, oh, this is wrong, and that's unsustainable, and that's unsustainable, you know, that's the easy bit. And I thought, like, okay, so where, what would then be the alternative source of growth and the alternative source of, you know, this kind of redistribution that you need? Again, it's not about charity. It's about just providing the demand and the economy so they can keep growing. The only answer that I could come up with is that you tax wealth that does not contribute to keeping consumption levels up. What that means is that taxing consumption in the form of value-added tax is nuts, because you need that consumption, right, to keep your economy growing. What you want to tax is wealth that does not contribute to consumption. So what that means is, of course, the counter-argument that you get and that we have been getting for 3 decades of financial globalization now is that you can't do that, because as soon as you start taxing wealth, then that wealth will just disappear to Switzerland or to Luxembourg or to the Cayman Islands or wherever, right? So you have to tax something that is immobile, and that was us consuming at the supermarket. Now, I think that that's a phony argument. I think if you want to, you can tax wealth. But, you know, then for starters, you know, if you think that mobile wealth cannot be taxed as impractical, be taxed, then unfortunately I don't see any other way out than taxing immobile wealth. And that starts, for example, with real estate here. Again, I don't say that because I think we need to help the poor people and to make them consume more cheaply, because otherwise I don't see where that demand should come from if debt is not the answer. Now, the second half of your question, is it likely that the European people will still subscribe to some kind of common democratic order? I think if you know, ask your average Greek citizen on the streets of Athens these days, you know, whether he looks forward, you know, to more centralization of powers in Brussels, chances are that you get no for an answer.
Wait, I have someone who is informed about this.
Yes, I have to agree that this is the case in Greece right now. So I didn't make the question because you covered the majority of the points that I would like to. Compliment on the topics you have mentioned. I don't know whether you have read some articles of Mr. Varoufakis.
I don't think.
He's a Greek professor in economics, and he has to cope with, has proceeded with a modest proposal about how the Europeans should deal with the crisis. And there were 3 steps. He's recognizing that the crisis had a twin character. On the one hand, it was the problem of a budgetary discipline from the southern countries. On the other hand, it was the banking sector that had accumulated all the debt from the crisis from the southern periphery. So he comes up with the conclusion that the Europeans dealt with the one part of the crisis, mm-hmm. the budgetary discipline of the southern countries, and they did not touch upon the banking sector. The second, that's why the solution he proposed had to deal with the recapitalization of the banks that have accumulated the whole debt. This was the step one. The second step had to deal with recognizing which debt of these countries, the southern countries, is sustainable and which is not. Because I cannot force the German or the Dutch people, in the discussion of the Eurobonds, I cannot urge the German or the Dutch people to pay for my own debt building the Eurobonds, because this is the case. But in case they regard that there is a certain amount of money, of debt, that they could pay for, if they regard that there is a part of the Greek debt that is sustainable, and this part of the debt is compatible with the Maastricht criteria, it's till 60%, let's say. This 60% from the whole countries could be built up on a Eurobond platform. And the third part of the proposal has to deal with the utilization of the European Investment Bank for the fallen states, like Greece, like Italy maybe, Spain, Portugal, which could be utilized in order to not to redistribute, that I mean not putting more taxes on the German and the Dutch people to bring money on the Greeks, rather than making investments more helpful for the Dutch and the Germans in Greece, and contributing to the recycling of the money in this region. So I have to, in order to complete my comment, I would like to say that I was really fascinated by the way you're thinking, because it was not something, it was not entangled in the whole monetary conceptualization we have built European Union upon. It was something, it had more differentiated character that I had expected. So this was my point I would like to make.
Do you like to address, or would you like to continue answering the question about democracy?
I don't know what would like to comment on the proposal that that he made, these three steps. I don't know whether you think that they are sustainable or not.
I think the third one is interesting. You know, I think they're all interesting, but I think, you know, the third one, using the European Investment Bank, because of course, you know, from what I've told you so far, you know, that should already, you know, set off a red light flashing again, because that's, you know, lending money and borrowing money. The thing here is, of course, you know, there is then, in that sense, I think even more nuance is required. I think there is a difference between sustainable debt in the sense that it's sustainable, either because it doesn't lead to an automatic spiraling out of control, that's one thing, and also because it's actually used for some kind of productive investment. Right? So debt to keep consumption levels up by channeling it into our pockets directly or indirectly through governments that borrow to finance welfare state spending. But that is unsustainable, because it doesn't actually lead to any. If you borrow, in contrast, to invest in some kind of productive capacity, then that is a completely different story. I don't think you want to rely on that too much, because of all the vagaries of being able to anticipate, if now you start building factories on a massive scale, whether 30 years from now, well, they'll be as productive as right now, you hope they will be. It's kind of a, you know, risky strategy. But I think there is a difference there. So to say, you know, you can use an institution like that to this kind of an end. You know, if you think back, for example, to the Marshall Plan, well, in many ways that had, you know, not dissimilar characteristics from what you were describing. It was good for Europe, and it was good for the U.S. So in that sense, I think there is definitely something to that that could be considered.
Okay, not forgotten.
Well, by now my question, I think, has been partially already answered, but I was just wondering what would be your proposition, how to get that money of rich people. Basically, you are saying that sustainable growth could be reached by redistribution. Would it be through some adjusted and coordinated fiscal policies in European level?
I think it would have to involve, I think there are two components here. There is a, say, if you will, a vertical and horizontal component. There is a question of coordination here, certainly across the Eurozone countries, and I think that's something where, at least from what we hear from America, Mr. Sarkozy, you know, there has always been talk of some kind of, for example, harmonized corporate tax, has often been discussed, and I think there is some movement on that front. But I think the second point is that you do have to rejig important parts of where you tax in the economy, you know, where the flow of money as it, you know, goes through the economy, where you say, okay, this is the point where we tax that money. So it's not even about increasing necessarily taxation, but making sort of like a taxation regime that encourages investment and consumption rather than saving money and, you know, lending them the money to the U.S. government or lending it, you know, to somebody else at the far end of the world or investing it in gold. Right? So if you have a relatively increasing value-added tax and at the margin you're discouraging spending for consumption and you're relatively encouraging, for example, buying gold or something like that, for us, I think, you should be doing exactly the opposite. So it's not necessarily only saying, you know, tax rich people much more, but I think, you know, that will be part of a strategy that tries to think of, you know, where is the money come from that sustains certain growth. That's the way I. Yeah, I mean, and no sustainable economic growth with taxation that fits for that. Again, you know, I said it before and I say it again because it's become so unpopular these days. This is not a call for charity. I mean, I'm not, you know, necessarily so compassionate with the poor. But John Maynard Keynes, that was what he was all about. That was one of his key insights from the Great Depression. If you don't have the consumption there, then you'll get deflation and just, you know, a spiraling down of the economy, which is bad for everybody, not just for the poor, also for the rich.
In 1989, Peter Hall published an edited volume with the title The Political Power of Economic Ideas, and it was about Keynesianism. And I think that your policy position, if I may call it like this, we have two elements in the discussion. I would like to try to discuss them a little bit more. The policy idea in Daniel's introduction is how to redistribute welfare. So that could be the political power of economic ideas, but then the question first is, how do we want to do that? And there was, you know, a wary young man being left, not living in Amsterdam, where everyone is left-wing, of course, and you live in The Hague, maybe, or in Leiden. What? So that is, of course, an issue. What support for policy?
Marco, where does Leiden figure on your... So if Amsterdam is left and Leiden, how does that fit
Well, it depends
in?
On where you are in Leiden.
Oh, no. That's too nuanced for me.
It's a microcosmos of ideology. But I would like to go discuss a little bit more this substantive redistribution issue. And then the last part of the debate, I would like to move more towards the political representation question about how to move forward with European institutions if we want to keep them. So who would like, and I'm another man, I was hinting at some lady mixing in the debate, because otherwise I know that economic and fiscal policy is a very masculine topic, but you're not sitting here for nothing. So who would take up the challenge and ask or make a remark or a point about this? Now, don't tell me that there's no one. Is there? No, but Luz, I can give you the microphone. You will have a question about the policy, right?
I won't have a question about economic policy, but I will have, it's just a clarification question, actually. There was a statement in your presentation that I was quite struck by when you said that somehow when we delegate to the European Parliament, that the European citizens or citizens of national states will become more in control. Mm-hmm. And this could be perhaps perceived as a controversial statement. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering if you could elaborate, maybe more clarify what you meant by more control and what makes European Parliament a special representative body where citizens all of a sudden will be more in control.
Yeah, no, very good question. I think it's an important point, again, that European citizens need to wrap their head around. If you think, you know, if you think that there is a trade-off, and you know, this has been theorized in many ways, you know, so if we have different scales of representation, so, you know, I don't know, like we living in one neighborhood, we could have our own neighborhood committee, and then as a municipality, and then as a province, and then as a national state, so on and so forth. Of course, you know, the higher you move up on that scale, the further removed, you know, that representative body will be from you, and the less likely it's going to be that it will really mirror your specific preferences, right? The European, if we're lucky, demos of what, 350 million people, you know, in your neighborhood block, I don't know, maybe there's like 350. So in that sense, if you only look at that axis, then you say the further removed that representative body is, you know, the less well represented you as an individual citizen will be. But I think the yardstick should be a different one. Namely, that directness of representation of you should be discounted by, you know, the real world impact that decisions by that particular body can have. You know, it's all nice and fine by the Luxembourg people or by the Greek people to think, oh, that's so terrible. You know, Brussels, you know, they're doing all these things, as if the government in Athens or the Greek parliament could, out of, you know, by its own device, completely change the world in which Greece finds itself. They cannot. You know, it's still a choice that you can make, but it's not as though if you say, well, let's repatriate decision-making to national parliaments, then all of a sudden, then you're in control of your own destiny. So you'll still be whipped around by all sorts of economic forces and flows that just push your country this way or that way, right? And so far, we're only talking about Europe. We're not talking about the rest of the world, but we're not talking about China. We're not talking about India. We're not talking about Brazil, about Russia, about the United States. So if you say we want somehow to be in control, then I think the best way to be in control, in spite of the fact that we're removed from that body in Brussels, is if we find a way of deciding things collectively, taking a stand collectively rather than everybody for themselves, where people find that actually they can't really change the circumstance on which they find themselves. That's what I meant, how, you know, indeed, counterintuitive in a way, but actually puts you more in charge if you do things collectively rather than on a small scale.
No, I don't think that it's actually counterintuitive. Hence, I wanted you to clarify a little bit of that position, because it's a little bit of an economies of scale argument, right? You're going to get more by sort of associating with larger body that will have more impact generally. But then you probably run, it's not about the remoteness of that institution from you in terms of distance or geography, but it's more about political parties and how political parties will actually feel that, you know, where they are on the representativeness scale and how much they have incentive to provide you these options, right? So I think it's more about having a more integrated political system that goes along with it than a sort of, distance sort of derived representation and, you know, right, these economies of scale argument, if I understand it correctly.
Mm-hmm. I think there are two issues that scale. My first one, I think you said the keyword yourself already, that's about incentive, mm-hmm, right? And, you know, political parties, you know, just as any other bureaucratic and or entrepreneurial organization, they're very good at reacting to incentives. So if all of a sudden to be successful as the Greens or the Liberals or the Conservatives, you really need to get your act together on a European level, because it's either that or you just perish, then I'm sure they'll be pretty quick. You know, if that is where the power resides and you need to Europeanize as a political movement or party, you know, to be able to thrive, then people will do that. If it doesn't take that, you know, then you go on in your national way. You know, something that we partially still see right now, right? You know, where still national parliaments are the most important arenas, you know, and say the SPD in Germany, the Social Democratic Party, thinks of itself, you know, in spite of all the protestation of the country, first and foremost as the SPD, and then there is the Party of European Socialists, but that's really something that's, you know, remote in the shadow, because national elections matter. That's an incentive structure that they react to, and, you know, rightly so. If that were changed, I think you would quickly see a readaptation of the party. The second thing is, you said, well, it's not really about geographical remoteness, agreed. I think an important aspect that we haven't mentioned yet so far is, say, for example, you know, diversity among the European people. It's not only, but then again, if you come to think of it, you also find massive diversity within national societies right now of all stripes and colors. You know, political diversity, cultural diversity, economic diversity. You know, and that works, you know, more or less. So, you know, diversity is something that democratic systems accommodate right now, and I think they could also accommodate potential union.
Yeah, even in Belgium, there is a government now, right?
Yes.
Okay, we have 15 minutes, and I would like to go a little bit more in depth with you about these challenges of representation. No taxation without representation. Can you also reverse to this? Can you also say no representation without more taxation and control? That's the six-pack proposal that is being discussed and recycled in the European Summit discussions. I would like to add to the discussion about democracy in Europe and the future of the European Parliament. Is it a siren call that Daniel makes for more strength, or is it something that, yeah?
Yeah, I'm going to challenge you a little bit. I actually agree with everything that you've said regarding the economic policy, and I think you're right about the need for more political integration and all those things. However, I'm not convinced that the European Parliament is a sustainable solution, although I'm not sure if one exists, right? So I would challenge you by saying, I don't think you're really arguing, your proposal really suggests a sustainable alternative, but one that buys the EU a lot more time to develop this demos, right? And I think this demos trap is a bigger problem than I think your presentation lets on, in the sense that parliaments can be a huge source for disunity as well, in the sense of now it provides this kind of centralized location where politics can be dramatized in a way that can actually lead to more disunity, right? So as an American, you mentioned how someone in Massachusetts now considers themselves part of the same American demos as someone from New York. A better example would be Connecticut and New York, because one of the reasons why the U.S. left the Articles of Confederation in the first place was that New York wanted to invade Connecticut. So the idea was, is when you talk about when this demos happened in the U.S. case, it really happened with the Civil War, right? It wasn't and that Civil War was largely begun on the basis of an election to our national body that left one particular region feeling permanently not in control of their future, right? And this comes to how the political parties are organized and how these interests happen. So I would argue that your proposal probably puts you into a position where you're now into like the U.S. Constitution phase after the Articles of Confederation, and you're waiting for your next big crisis to, or some evolutionary process to create this demos. So, well, I mean, I applaud it, but I also think that, you know, the concerns about the demos trap are far more serious than I think your presentation lets on, and that it just buys us time for more troubled roads ahead. So I'd like to hear your response to that.
Yeah. No, I mean, you're right. And the other examples that I mentioned, I mean, you know, Germany, one of the cases that I know best, you know, German unification, not reunification, but German unification in 1871, that came in very handy, to say the very least, that you could, you know, strike up a war with the French, you know, to kind of like make that happen. And as you say, the list of examples where it, you know, needed some kind of external threat, you know, to bond people together or to weld them together, that list is very long. Does that make it less likely that something similar is going to happen in Europe now? Yes, I think that is correct. But when you say, well, you know, then you're waiting for an existential crisis to make that happen, that I think we have already. I mean, that crisis, you know, unfortunately, it's not there in the citizens' mind yet. But I think a moment must come. I find it difficult to imagine otherwise when, you know, continuing on the road that we've been traveling so far, also in the minds of citizens, is no longer an option. And that, I think, is something that so far with the crisis that we faced, first the financial crisis, then the economic crisis, and now this political crisis, you know, has been one of the major mistakes with the hindsight that many politicians have made. If you think of the economic crisis, politicians always thought that their job was to calm everything down. I tell everybody, oh, it's okay, it's not that bad, no need to worry, because, you know, they thought that in the margin they could make a difference to market sentiment. That's a plausible gamble. If you can pull that off, talk about this reflexivity, the importance of expectations, if you can pull that off, calm everything down, then you've done a good job. But if you find that you can't do that, then all of a sudden you're in a trap, because things are really starting to go bad. And up until yesterday, you've been telling your voters that you were in control, that everything was fine, they needn't worry. And now you realize, okay, you know, maybe time has come that I start telling them the truth. But then you need to turn around 180 degrees. At the kind of Merkel trap, Rutte was in a similar kind of situation, you know, where you've sort of like, by trying to gamble on this one role, you know, you find yourself that you can't really live up to that other role, which is, you know, making clear to your own citizens, you know, that emergency is really high. Doesn't change the fact, you know, that at some point, you know, people will realize one way or another that a stark choice has to be made. And then I cannot do more than hope that for Europe it won't take a war to weld people together. Maybe you're right. You know, I think the odds are not terribly good. But, faith in, you know, sort of like at least, you know, some modicum of reason in people hasn't left me sufficiently to think that it's not at least possible for people to come out of this country.
Okay. First, are you studying European integration history? Exactly what I would like someone with a historical perspective, addressing Brendan's question, your answer. So could you?
I think Professor Griffiths has a better historical perspective than I do. But I would like to support your idea that it's very difficult to create a demos and a proper legitimation of very difficult decisions being made at a European level. Now, you say national governments cannot address the financial situation right now. They will just be floated around on the by the financial markets. Europe can, you say? I think it's still difficult for Europe to act that way. One of the suggestions made lately has been a European taxation on financial transactions. I'm not sure whether Europe can confront the financial markets and tame them in that way. But considering they would, then that really needs the support of the European populace. A European demos is needed for that sort of action. There is no demos. For a demos, you need time, you need a European public sphere, which isn't there. Everything is still looked at from a national perspective. So there is no perspective or no real view on European demos being created. There's no, I can't see it coming. So we have a little bit of problem of legitimacy considering European Parliament not being a way of legitimizing Europe, yet we need fast action to address these issues. Now, we have a problem of demos, and we have a problem of can Europe really deal with this situation? I would like you to hear your views on that.
Let's stick with the European demos for a second. See, I don't think, you know, the war option, you know, let's skip that for them. I don't think that we necessarily need to wait for that somehow to bubble up out of nowhere, right? I think, you know, there is a leadership role for political leaders, for different political parties taking a stand, for media. I'm not saying that they can just, you know, turn around and, you know, there is European demo. But, you know, these things are institutionalized in particular facets, pockets, dimensions of society. If, you know, that's part of, you know, what we're talking about today, you know, if in forums such as this, or you know, in the Dutch parliament over there, or different representations of the political parties in the Netherlands, you know, if they came to the conclusion that Europe was really where it's at, and it was either make it or break it, you know, maybe then they could, you know, stand up to the Dutch people and say, hey, listen, guys, I think we've got some tough choices to make. You know, the PVV, Geert Wilders, has a fairly clear idea on that. D66, the Liberals, also have a fairly clear idea on that. There are many other parties. Not quite clear. They certainly don't come out and say it's either option A or option B. We're for either A or option B. You know, they're for nothing or something in between. Where I don't think that in between is an option A. Right? So part of our mission, we're also agents in this. Right? You are, I am. So I'm talking to you today saying, well, listen, you know, I think you better start thinking about those choices that you have. If you think for the media, for example, at least in, if you will, certain political, societal elites, so I think there is something forming there. I mean, if you read the Financial Times, you know, these days, the opinion pieces that they have, they're sourced from throughout Europe, even throughout the world. There's different apps that you have these days on your iPhone, Press Europe, for example, that collect in 10 different languages, you know, key articles from media from all over the place. I think there is something happening. There is a demand and a supply, but I think there is this specific role for political leader to realize what situation we're in. And then I think they cannot just make it happen out of nowhere, but they can, you know, rather than exclusively focusing on their national publics, see what the choices are, and then actually start telling citizens what it's at.
Yeah, I enjoyed the lecture. Quick question, very much. And as a federalist, I sympathize with the solution. The way there, though, I can't see happening. As these crises go every 2 or 3 months, and there'll be another one in 3 months' time because they're not going to solve it this time round, every time it's ebbing away popular support, not just for Europe, but also for the political system. Popular parties are beginning to lose their base. You can see it as a radicalization on right and left. The solutions being suggested, what, sending in the hard gang to go and beat up the Greek budget. If I were Greece, I'd never vote for anything European or carrying a European label as long as I live. I just don't see the way forward, and I don't see now is the leap forward to a more federalist structure. I think even an attempt to do that would doom Europe forever. I've got a feeling that what you're going to see is partly in your direction of a small group of countries that are willing to take that move towards a more federal state, and the status quo ante for the rest. And it's probably going to start with Greece at some stage moving out of the euro, and I think it'll be followed by others before this crisis is over.
No, see, again, I'm not saying that it's likely, and I wouldn't be surprised, you know, Greece, maybe your home country as well, you know, would be part of the EU light club. But I think that EU light club, which exists already now for those countries that are not members of the single currency, will become lighter still. So all I would ask for, if I had my way, was, you know, to present people with that choice. It's not obvious to me that if a minority of countries does decide to go ahead with some kind of Paris-Berlin axis at its center, that the countries that do not decide to join that club, you know, will be much more than, you know, what we now have, for example, in the European Economic Area, something like that, where Norway, say Iceland, you know, they're somehow associated with Switzerland in some respects. They're somehow, you know, they're part of this European thing. They're not really in. And I wouldn't be surprised if the countries that don't take the leap towards more integration, fine, it's up to them, it's up to their citizens, but they end up in more that kind of a situation where many of the big questions that are actually all linked up together, you know, will be taken without them. And it's their choice.
Okay. I saw someone with a hand, but you already asked one question, and I would that's okay. It keeps you in case of. But students of European Union history? Okay, and you want to ask a question? Okay, not too long.
No, I wanted to bring in, when we talked about Demos, language, but you already went into that a bit, and not language as an obstacle, because for European Demos per se, but also through the media, but you already said it takes time to develop, and there is some movement with things like Press Europe and Euronews, which are also subsidized, I think, by the European Commission.
They subsidize all sorts of things. You'd be surprised. Yeah.
No, yeah, I looked some up. But yeah, so no, I wanted to ask you, like, don't you see, because you made the comparison with United States, but there is a big difference. I mean, it's the obvious thing in every debate. Language, what are you going to do about it?
I think history will have to show whether that really is an obstacle. It could be. Could be that it's, you know, not a causal relationship, but only a correlation. You know, we've had a particular kind of nation making, you know, many of the examples that have come by. And in those instances, we did see a combination of, you know, growth, or, you know, the coming into being, or the solidification of a common language, as well as a political system. Is that a correlation, or is there really a causal link there? I'm not quite sure. You know, as a political economist, I would still tend to think, even though it's not obvious that I have it at the right end, but, you know, that fairly narrowly defined interests of people will, at the end of the day, trump vague feelings of identity, unless very much at that stake. So I would hope that, you know, if European people realized, you know, that this was really something that was actually close to their heart and mattered to see the thing. You know, I don't need to read Greek, I don't need to be in love with Greek, I don't even need to like Greek food. But if sort of like having food on my table with my family, all of whom speak, you know, Dutch and German, if that depends on me working together politically with those Greek guys over there, then I'm happy to. And, you know, so could be an obstacle, yes. I'm not sure whether, you know, you can't have some sort of transmission belt, you know, that would take care of that. So, and as you see in this room right here, right now, you know, you and I, we don't have problem speaking. We communicate perfectly well for our purposes. And back home at the dinner table, we speak another language. Works perfectly fine. Lots of countries, you know, where you have, take a country like India, for example. Does that have a single language? How many does it have? More than 800. Yeah, great democracy. Fine. You know, and, you know, there's many more examples like that. So I don't think, you know, that is necessarily an obstacle. It helps to have a common one, but I don't think it's an essential.
Okay, happy to give you the floor.
Thank you. Well, maybe moving on to a prospect to next weekend, and also put it a bit more into the world of now, because we're all fantasizing of how it could be and how it should be, but not really how it's gonna be. And I would like to ask you something about your first point. You were saying that the financial market is breathing in the neck of all the politicians at the moment. We see Germany, France, the Netherlands being at the urge of devaluation by settlers at wars. On the other hand, we see Europe wanting to control, wanted to check on settlers at wars, Moody's, if they are doing their job correctly. So we're controlling each other at the moment right now. How do you suggest the politicians act at the moment? And not letting the financial markets determine too much of the solution that is coming up.
Okay, as far as these rating agencies are concerned, I think it's understandable that politicians are irritated by, you know, being put on a credit watch. At the same time, I think it's, truth be told, I think they should be on a credit watch. You know, the world we live in 2011 is not the world we lived in 2006. Talked earlier about this reflexivity in financial markets, you know, that if things look good, you know, then at least for a while they actually turn out well, and if they don't look so well, they actually don't turn out so well. You know, and they were very positive as exactly part of that mechanism in the upswing, and they're relatively more negative now on the down. That's part of the deal. And that doesn't have so much to do with them as institutions as it has to do with just the way that any financial market participant would evaluate. You know, if you would take those away and every pension fund or whoever else could just come to their own assessment of what's going on, I think they would be even more pessimistic about the prospects of, say, Dutch or German government debt than Standard and Poor's and Moody's are. Right? So I think, you know, this is really shooting the messenger. What can you do about, or to what degree should you accommodate that breathing down your neck of these financial markets? Well, as I said, I think there was an excessive fixation on that a little bit, because what has happened now, you know, it has spun a little bit out of control. You know, the actual interest that governments pay on their debt is something that was agreed to a long time ago, so that in secondary markets where debt is actually traded, these yields rise a little bit. Doesn't mean that the debt burden rises on the spot. It's only when new debt needs to be issued that that becomes the benchmark for the next batch of debt that you sell. Right? So, you know, it's not as though Italy doesn't pay more interest now. It will have to. It will have to refinance its debt now. That's when. Right? So I think, you know, it's actually a little less bad, you know, than many people think it is. And then arguably the media has reported the whole thing. Question still remains, to what degree can the European Central Bank be part of that solution? It has the silver bullet. You may think that it's not a very good one, but it has the silver bullet that it could, you know, by itself start financing an important part of the government debt, as has happened partially in the United States, for example, where the Federal Reserve System has started buying big time into U.S. government debt. And, you know, of course, the dirty secret is that since Mr. Draghi has taken over at the helm of the European Central Bank, the amount of government paper that the European Central Bank has already risen substantially. You know, this has been a few weeks, three or four. So, you know, actually, quietly, they are already doing some of that. Doesn't change the fact that, of course, you know, the disquiet that there is there, I think, is tangible and is real. Most important thing for me is that you don't confuse finding some kind of short-term measure to stop, you know, the fire from burning with getting sustainable solution for the long term. You can somehow do those things at the same time, because I think at the end of the day, also what these people in the financial markets want to see is something that actually looks like a sustainable, valid model for where Europe wants to go from here. So austerity only and nothing else, no, that doesn't fly well in financial markets, because actually it's not a good idea. That is going to be bad for you. And so financial markets are actually right if they think, well, that's just going to, you know, keep us in a downward spiral. So I think, you know, if you have the right proper kind of solution, then I do have hope, faith, that in combination, you know, with just, you know, telling them to shut up a little bit, that's excellent.
Okay, there's time, space for one final short question, which raises the burden for anyone to ask one. But is there someone who would like to bring up another point? Well, you are not a student anymore. You are. Oh, well. Two questions.
This is not natural grey hair, yeah. you mentioned money that's not being used, and it'd be nice to get that into the system and to be productive. There seems to be a lot of money in China. Is there potential there?
There were moments in this crisis, I think two or three, when that was seriously considered. You know, at some point, you know, Italian government debt, you know, there was a sense that Berlusconi was sort of like, you know, trying to peddle some of his debt to the Chinese, and there was another moment when, you know, there was involvement in Greek government debt where China could be a role. I think I talked earlier about imbalances that would somehow need to be, you know, put in balance back again, so within societies, between European societies. And then, of course, there's, you know, the bigger picture yet, you know, the global imbalances, where the first axis would be one between the United States and China, you know, something that needs to be put right. So if you ask me, you know, there is something fishy and definitely unsustainable about the buildup of credits, as it were, on the Chinese end of the ledger here. that is mostly something where I think if we want the global economy to be on a sustainable footing for the next, say, what, 20, 30 years, you know, thinking farther ahead is foolish anyway. But then, you know, that is where I think, you know, sort of like, you know, that rebalancing would need to take shape. I think because the European Union as a whole is kind of like, okay, most of the, the import and export imbalances are within the European Union as a trading bloc. It's actually kind of okay on a global scale. That I don't think that, you know, getting money from China would be a solution without something going the other way. And I wouldn't know what that'd be. I think that rebalancing is something that needs to happen within Europe, and that Chinese money, they would want something back. And I'm not sure what that could be.
Because there was talk of them buying some infrastructure, wasn't there?
Yeah, I think that there is room for some investment, but I'm not sure whether that is something like the answer to that problem. I think it's fair enough, you know, for them to acquire the ports in Greece, these kinds of things. I don't think that Europeans should rely on that, on an answer. Should be invited to come in, all good. But.
Okay, I'm not going to ask whether you are a student, but ask your question.
I am a student. Thank you for being here and for answering all our questions. I want to go back to your speech, and you were indicating one of the things that we didn't touch upon yet, and that was the rising inequality between the rich and the poor. It has always been a problem in the United States. Recently, it has been increasing in India as well. And you mentioned that in the OECD countries, it's going up as well. So, and separately, you also mentioned about a new philosophy. So other than this problem of mobility of credit and our inability to control where investment in the neoliberal market would lead to, what kind of this new philosophy might look like? You know, I think that would be a good last question. of not just a redistribution of wealth, but, the margin of how much we get paid compared to a top few people. Thank you.
Yes. Of course, you know, it's nice to get the suggestion that, you know, I haven't been idealistic enough already, so, you know, we need to raise the bar still higher. See, the thing, you know, I have my personal views on, you know, what I think, you know, the good life is about, and how I think, you know, people in society should live together, and what would be sensible yardsticks for a fair distribution of wealth. Truth is, though, that I think, you know, that that's a, you know, a whole different debate altogether. Because, you know, what I try to emphasize so far, that, you know, even though, you know, I'd be privately happy if we were to get to, you know, what I think would be, you know, more fair distribution of wealth in society, I think the main political argument right now, when we talk about the euro crisis, is not so much one about fairness, which I think will always be contested, but it's simply one about, you know, what makes economic sense right now. Right. So yes, I would totally applaud, you know, if we, in any way, you know, I, you know, step away from, you know, what seems times like a societal obsession with material wealth. But even if we don't think that, even people, you know, who are completely happy in sort of like consumer society, even for them, I think, you know, if they want to keep up that kind of a lifestyle, then I think they'd be well advised to accord to economic order in which you see some kind of distribution of wealth. So, you know, what I get from your sentiment, I would probably agree to that. I think the good news is, for my proposals to be at least sensible, you don't even need people who share that sentiment. All they need is some economic sense.
Okay. Well, as you say, a good final question. So let's conclude. And I have a question to you, actually, because what strikes me in this whole, not only this debate, but also in the news, and I am a bit sad about that, actually, Sherp, is that we don't hear much from the European Parliament in this whole euro crisis. So actually, my suggestion, Daniel, is, lifting the scales, why wouldn't you be on the list for some party for the next European parliamentary elections so that you can also practice the ideals in the European arena? And then talking about Demos, you can, of course, sit and wait for Demos to emerge. But why not give the good example? And if there is one arena in the European Union where that example has to be given, then is the European Parliament. We can be more or less skeptical, but this is a place where I think we face a challenge. Think about that suggestion that I have tomorrow morning when you pick your bicycle. Maybe you take a different route. I would like you to thank you very much on behalf of the House of Europa and the Montesquieu Institute. Not giving you a bottle of wine, which we normally do, but you already got one 2 weeks ago in another lecture, remember? So I have something that is not the European Parliament, but it is a book about the Dutch Eurocommissioners, of course published under auspices of the Montesquieu Institute. Thanks very much again, Daniel, for the inspiring discussion that you were willing to have with us. Thanks very much. That deserves an applause.
Thank you.
And I would like to, because you can, of course, I know that you will never have enough about these kinds of discussions and presentations. So if you don't have enough yet of it, take a look at our website, Montesquieu Institute, where you find an announcement. I don't want to speak in competition with the European Union Studies Program, but we have a masterclass that begins end January and is about the European crisis, about the different faces of the European crisis, a political face, a cultural face, an economic face. And we will have a mixture of keynote speakers, partly from academics, but also partly from the professional, as we say, the real world of policymaking and politics.